Gold and the distant peaks shot toward the sky.
That dream is gone, Gideon said. But your people live. Nothing else matters. Keep them moving.
Chapter 23 Colonel Martell twisted around as a Cassatt fighter roared overhead. He let off a burst of shots with a brrrt of rapid fire and turned his attention away as the fighter exploded. The Cassatt had hit the Terran column within seconds of their arrival over the mesa. Martell and his four lances of armor had reacted to the sudden reversal of fortune as best they could, but the sheer number of enemy fighters and a wide field of Terran targets turned the mesa into a hellscape before the first Crescent fighters finished their attack run. Smoke rose from the destroyed personnel carriers. Dead Rangers littered the battlefield, most still on fire. Heat from the blaze and the blast craters left from Cassatt strafing runs played hell with his armor sensors, and he cut the IR feed. The bam, bam, bam of Crescent fighter bolts hitting the ground closed in behind him. Someone shoved him out of the way, and a near miss sent shrapnel of pulverized rock bouncing off his armor. Martell rolled onto his feet and saw Cassatt landers lowering into the city a bare mile away. The enemy commander obviously didn't share the same caution that Martell had when planning the operation to take the city from the Ibaras. Missiles shot up from the streets and from rooftops, destroying more than a dozen landers that crashed with fireballs into the ground. He watched as one took a hit to the engines and veered to a side and into a building, ripping the roof off before tipping belly up and plummeting to the ground.
"We're getting killed out here, sir!"
Tongea shouted as he fired his Gauss cannon at a pair of Crescent fighters banking around the Terran column.
"I am well aware."
Martell saw a tracked personnel carrier next to a burning wreck and saw the name stenciled on the front bumper. The carrier's rear hatch was down, and Rangers loaded casualties into the back. Martell ran over to the carrier and waved at a soldier who was standing in a cupola and shouting into a microphone.
"Colonel Jones, keep moving!"
Martell shouted.
"Get into the city!"
The Ranger commander shook his head, his skull mask catching the firelight from burning vehicles.
"The bars will shoot us too!"
Jones yelled into his microphone, then smashed the useless thing against the top of his APC.
"There's that chance, but I can guarantee you the Cassatt won't stop!"
Jones flinched as a bolt of Cassatt fire struck his vehicle's roof. Martell had a split second before Jones's vehicle exploded and the APC's treads blew out, sweeping Martell off his feet. He landed hard enough to feel the impact inside his womb. When his helm looked up, he saw the remains of Jones and his driver mangled inside the wreckage.
"Ulons! Odin's sons! Templars!"
Martell got up, the megaphones in his armor blaring.
"Forward! Get them moving!"
He limped forward, a blasted hunk of Jones's vehicle embedded in his knee servo. Martell went to an undamaged personnel carrier and banged against the driver's hatch twice.
"The city! Stampede! You get me?"
Martell shouted. The APC lurched forward, then continued at a slower pace. Martell kicked it in the rear hatch hard enough to leave a dent, and the APC gunned ahead. Tongea followed Martell's lead and applied physical encouragement to a pair of vehicles. Matthias and Duncan, the other armor soldiers in his lance, got the leading edge of the column moving. Martell sidestepped out of the way of an APC that had either lost the ability to steer or wasn't afraid to run over the armor commander. A warning icon flashed on his HUD, and he whirled around. More than a dozen Crescent fighters were coming right for him, flying low over the deck in three stacks.
"Action right! Counter air on my signal!"
Martell said. His HUD wavered as his armor came online with him, forming a thin barrier between the vulnerable Rangers and the oncoming fighters. Martell loaded Gauss shells into his cannons and felt the hum of the magnet coils through the arm. Dust billowed behind the fighters as they closed in.
"Mark outer targets and shift fire to center!"
Martell drew a bead on a fighter bobbing up and down just above the ground. His armor made the ballistic calculation for the long-range shot, and the fighter exploded.
"Who the hell?"
He looked at Tongea and the line of armor after him. The Maori shrugged. None of the rest of the armor's Gauss cannons were smoking. Martell looked back and found a half-dozen smoking craters where the attacking fighters had been. The Cassatt had broken off their attack and were in the middle of a dogfight with black fighter craft with forward-swept wings. A fighter roared overhead. Martell caught a Templar cross painted under the wings.
"That's not one of ours," Tongea said. Ibarans. If they keep not shooting at us, our situation will be slightly less terrible, Martell said.
To the city! Follow me!
He swung a hand overhead toward the embattled city and transformed his legs into treads, rolling forward at the point of his lance. The rest of his armor formed into a diamond-shaped formation. They closed on the city quickly. As he caught up to an APC, a line of broken track trailing from the left side, Martell shifted back into his walking configuration. The hatch was down, and rangers crouched next to it, about to abandon the vehicle.
Back inside!
Martell shouted. He ran to the front and grabbed the forward edge of the vehicle, the metal bending in his grip. Tongea herded the rangers back up the ramp, then broke the ramp off with a quick stomp and gripped the sides. The dozen rangers inside held very still as the armor hefted their entire APC off the ground and began running. When a Kasat fighter strayed too close, Tongea's rotary cannon snapped up and fired on it. Martell twisted his helm up and all the way around to watch the skies. A dogfight raged overhead. Black Ibaran fighters and gray Terran eagles battled the Kasat craft. Alien landers exploded and arced toward the planet on columns of smoke and fire. In the distance, pairs of the oversized landers took off and vanished over the mountains. Explosions popped throughout the sky, and Martell knew the battle extended well into orbit.
Saint Carlin, witness this day,
Martell said.
She's ever with us, brother, Tongea said.
They passed a burning building and dropped the APC next to a hastily formed motor pool in a parking lot. Captain Sobieski, standing next to open metal doors leading underneath a mostly intact building, motioned Martell over. Just beneath ground level were three Ibaran legionnaires, the faceplates of their armor covered with a subdued red Templar cross. A rabble of men and women in light armor and carrying Gauss carbines clustered behind them.
"This is my commander,"
Sobieski said, the rattle of Gauss fire and whoosh of missiles sounding in the distance.
"Captain Hansen,"
the legionnaire said, giving Martell a nod.
"I've got a company of reservists that are supposed to man the walls. How many rangers have you got?"
Martell looked back at the APCs. Just how few made it to the city hit him like a punch to the gut. The city's edge tapered down to a few low buildings and dirt. In the distance, where he'd seen the Kasat landers, a wide plume of dust rose up. Something big was coming.
"Maybe 200 walls?"
Martell asked. As if on cue, horns blared around them. Just beyond the city's edge, a 10-foot-tall slanted metal wall rose up out of the ground. Another section rose behind that, forming covered battlements with firing positions.
"That's a neat trick," Martell said to Hansen.
"We knew this day would come," he said. "Just didn't think it would come so soon."
"Sir!"
A ranger with blood-stained armor and a cracked faceplate jogged over to Martell.
"Major Whitelaw, I've got command of our rangers after we lost Jones and the XO."
"Major, I'll leave you with Hansen to coordinate local defense,"
Martell said, looking into the city where a lander lifted off a few blocks away.
"My armor has other priorities."
Hansen grabbed a reservist by the shoulder and shouted into the tunnel.
"We've got friendlies out here. If it's alien, shoot it. If it's human, then it's worth dying for. Move, move, move!"
He practically threw the man up the stairs, and Ibarans boiled out of the tunnel and made for the walls. Hansen looked up at Martell and beat a fist against his chest in salute. Martell banged his fist against his heart, and the ring carried along the wall.
"We'll man the wall, Colonel. Come running if you hear us shooting,"
Hansen said.
"Fight well."
Martell raised his Gauss cannons and took off running down the street.
"Templar, with me!"
Chapter 24. Roland felt the slow turn of his drop pod as it fell through Balmaseda's atmosphere, his borrowed armor detecting no rise in temperature. He ran a system check on his sensor. Nothing as large as a 3-suit drop pod could skirt through atmo with no friction heat.
"Stop screwing around, Beanhead,"
Morrigan said through their local IR.
"You'll trigger your active scanners and spotlight us for the enemy."
"Something's off with my sensors. Did your crews not integrate my womb correctly?"
Roland asked.
"I won't tell Master Chief Neves you said that,"
Morrigan said as she sent him a wire diagram of their drop pod.
"We're rigged for stealth. active thermal and atmo maskers. Hull will absorb or refract any radar waves. The pod takes more time and resources to assemble than our armor, but the cost is worth getting us to the ground in one piece to fight.
That sounds a lot better than those damned insertion torpedoes. And who are you calling a beanhead?
You, beanhead? You haven't done a combat drop yet, she said.
What? I've done 3 drops.
Not with us, you haven't.
Nicodemus popped up in Roland's HUD, a map of Balmaceda City with him. A red field bulged into the eastern part of the city.
Fortifications failed to emplace to the east. Hydraulics probably took a hit during the initial bombardment. Governor Thrace is moving what he can to stem the tide.
A line of blue traced along the enemy's advance and unit icons popped up behind it. Roland found some relief that the Ibarans hadn't strayed too far from Terran battle command methods.
Our LZ's near their reserve,
Nicodemus said.
We'll spearhead the counterattack. Can you do a skid stop, Beanhead?
You really should have asked me this before you loaded me into the drop pod.
Answer!
Roland flinched inside his womb. He wasn't in his old lance, and the lance he was with was about to drop into the middle of a fight. That he was joking around filled him with guilt.
Yes, sir. I'm rated excellent on skid stops and have done one in combat.
Roland said.
I'm telling him.
Morgan said.
Roland, 2 things you need to know. First, Nicodemus has a quantum dot communicator on his helm. Looks like a normal shortwave unit, but it has 2 red chevrons on it. That's how we're getting around the Cassatt jamming. If necessary, you take it and coordinate what you can with the city's defenders. We don't have many of them.
The only reason I'd need it is if you two are dead,
Roland thought.
Second, Terrans are here,
she said. Roland's eyebrows shot up. The implications raced through his mind, and he managed one word.
Oh. Good news is that we're fighting on the same side, for now,
Morgan said.
Your friend showed up intending to remove our colony and take everyone away in chains. We'll see if the truce holds long enough for us to get our people off the planet.
I won't fire on them,
Roland said.
Nor do we expect you to,
Nicodemus said.
Fight Cassatt. Help with the evac. What happens after that is anyone's guess.
Roland squirmed inside his womb. It was bad enough that he wore Ibarra colors on his armor, was prepared to shed blood for them. But the idea of fighting Terran forces almost made him want to throw up. He wouldn't fire on them, but to any ranger or strike marine watching him down a weapon sight, he looked like any other Ibarran armor.
Nicodemus, are there any Terran armor down there?
Roland asked.
Prep for drop, Nicodemus said. 3, 2, 1, mark.
The metal lid on his bay broke away, and Roland saw a distant mountain range. He had a split second to note the burning buildings and fighters battling around him. The pod pushed him out, and a wall of wind smacked into him. He kicked his feet down and activated the jetpack on his back. Jets blasted, slowing him almost to a stop. To one watching on the ground, it looked like a giant angel had suddenly appeared on wings of fire. Roland faced down a wide boulevard, wrecked and burning cars littering the road. Figures on foot milled around buildings leading all the way back to a highway that extended beyond the city, where the fortifications jutted a few feet above the ground. He jettisoned the pack and fell to the road, using his momentum to propel him into a run. A rifle shot snapped over a car, and Roland's HUD marked a Raka foot soldier. Just behind it were 3 Sanheel, none of whom looked prepared for Roland's arrival. Roland charged toward them, obliterating the Raka and the vehicle it was using for cover with a single Gauss round. Shields flared around the Sanheel, protecting them from the blast. The 3 readied their long rifles as Roland closed the distance. As he brought his Gauss cannons to bear, Roland swore he heard the Sanheel snort in laughter. He lowered his aim and fired at their feet. The round blew a hole in the ground and sent one of the centaurs stumbling into another. The impact fouled the other's aim and it fired into the air. Roland kicked a smoldering piece of the destroyed ground car at the 3rd Sanheel. He knew it wouldn't break through the alien shields, but the Sanheel flinched all the same, a victim of his own reflexes and instincts. Fort Knox trained armor to be armor, killing machines, not simply soldiers wearing a suit. If any Sanheel tried the same trick on him, they'd receive a bullet to the face at the same time they realized how clever they weren't. Roland grabbed the 3rd Sanheel's rifle and thrust the weapon against its chest, snapping it in half and earning a pained grunt from the alien. Roland grabbed the stunned Sonheel by the wrist and jammed the broken end of the rifle into its face. The metal pierced the Sonheel below the chin and stopped when it hit the top of his skull. A Sonheel thrust its rifle at Roland, but he caught it by the barrel and pushed the muzzle aside just as it fired. He felt heat flare against his shoulder. The alien snarled at Roland, spittle flecking from thick lips and off needle-sharp teeth. A bayonet snapped out from the side of the rifle, the blade humming as a cutting field formed along the edge. The Sonheel struggled to push the bayonet home, but its muscles were no match for Roland's armor.
"The flesh is weak,"
Roland said as he twisted his upper body around on the waist actuators, doing a 360 that ripped the rifle out of the Sonheel's grasp. Roland angled the butt of the weapon around and crushed his enemy's skull when it hit home. The final Sonheel ran off at a gallop before its companion hit the ground. Hefting the rifle up like a javelin, Roland hurled it. The blade passed through the shields and buried itself in the alien's hindquarters. It stumbled forward and reached back to grasp at the weapon, then froze, staring at Roland. The Sonheel's head exploded with a boom. Roland looked behind him. Nicodemus and Morrigan carried their Mauser recoilless rifles, and smoke rose off both barrels. Seeing them in their black armor in the middle of a combat zone caught him off guard, and his first reaction was to see them as the enemy, no matter how much time he'd spent with them out of armor. Then he looked down at his own black arms and legs, stained with alien blood.
"I am armor," he thought. "Just not the same armor I was." "Something wrong with your Mauser, Roland?"
Morrigan asked.
"I..."
Roland reached to his back and unsnapped the maglock, securing his own Mauser to his armor.
"I forgot I had it. Guess the field trials are a success?"
"The enemy made their push before Thrace could launch his," Nicodemus said. "We are behind enemy lines. You know what a Schwerpunkt is?"
"A small force that's made a breakthrough," Roland replied, looking into his Mauser's breech and checking that it was loaded.
"They still teach the classics at Nox,"
Morrigan said.
"Time to exploit that breakthrough."
Nicodemus pointed down the boulevard leading to the city.
"Let's find their headquarters and pay a visit."
The squeal of treads over broken concrete echoed down the city street. Ranger Jerry Morris huddled against a wall, nestled in a pile of broken glass and what remained of a cooler. The soft drinks it once held had burst apart in the blast that wrecked the room, leaving a thin film of sticky sugar mist on everything. The ranger's power armor kept him safe from minor cuts and abrasions that were part and parcel of urban combat, but knowing that he'd reek of rotting sugar in a few days gnawed at him. He clutched his Gauss rifle against his chest and quietly pulled a grenade from his belt. He took a quick glance over the windowsill and dropped back down. He couldn't see the tank, but it was close.
"Go now?"
One floor up, and a barren woman wearing light fatigues and a flak vest leaned over the side of a gap in the ceiling.
"No,"
Morris hissed.
"You wait for my signal."
A legionnaire grabbed her by the shoulder and yanked her away from the edge. Morris heard a one-sided conversation begin in Bosque as the professional soldier imparted wisdom on the militia woman. Morris looked over at Yeltsin, his squadmate a few windows over. Yeltsin mimed the yakking mouth with his hand. In the hours since the Rangers had barely made it into the city, nothing had gone right. Comms were down, the chain of command was remade and then broken again after the next Kassat attack hit a command post and killed half the remaining officers. Morris's squad got separated from what remained of their platoon when Raqqa overran their fighting position. A group of Ibaran defenders had pulled them into a tunnel and incorporated him and Yeltsin into their ad hoc defense team. This, he decided, was not in the recruitment video he'd seen back in Phoenix. The few legionnaires had proved more than capable. The militia all seemed to have been through basic training and knew which end of the rifle to point at the enemy, but their tactical acumen fell off rapidly after that. He heard the tank stop, then the snap and squeal of treads against pavement as it changed direction. Placing his thumb against the grenade, Morris set it to anti-armor close range. The grenade would explode into a shaped charge and send a small depleted uranium lance of metal into whatever he threw it at. Getting close enough to do the job was the hard part. The floor bumped up, knocking debris everywhere. Morris fumbled with his rifle and tried to scramble into the corner. A metal hatch lifted up and slammed into the floor, sending dust billowing everywhere. Glowing lights pierced through the cloud and a giant shadow rose up. Morris thumbed his safety off, his training taking over.
Friendly.
Gideon's voice cut through the dust. The upper half of his armor became clear as the dust settled. Morris glanced out a window again, the sound of the Cassatt tank lost in the noise of Gideon's arrival.
Tank,
Morris said.
What did you call me?
Gideon asked.
Cassatt tank!
Morris jammed a thumb at the wall. Gideon crawled out of the tunnel in the floor and knelt next to the blown-out gap in the building's wall.
How many?
He asked.
We see two up here,
the Legionnaire said from the second floor. Gideon's helm and rotary cannon snapped up. The Legionnaires ducked away.
They're friendly too,
Morris said.
Where did you come from?
Outlying pump station. I have civilian prisoners and they're wounded,
Gideon said. Ator climbed out of the tunnel and helped more of his people out.
Ator, this is not the utility district.
No, we should have taken that left,
Ator grumbled.
Prisoners,
the Legionnaire said from the second floor.
You've got the wrong idea here.
Tactical situation's been in flux,
Yeltsin said to Gideon.
We've gone from controlled chaos to complete mess and back again more than once. Ibaras are evacuating their civilians through the spaceport. Colonel Martell's got us holding the line while that happens. And in the absence of further orders, we'll attack,
Morris said.
Where's Martell?
Gideon asked.
Sir, I don't exactly know where the hell we are,
Morris pointed to the ceiling.
Locals don't need maps and have yet to lead us astray.
Gideon looked up at the Legionnaire.
Can you get these civilians to an evac point? Got one on a stretcher,
the armor said.
I can,
the Ibaran said, pointing toward the Cassatt lines.
But we won't get far with those tanks on us, and we'll move slow with the wounded.
I'll deal with the tank,
Gideon said.
I didn't come here to babysit. Agnar?
The other armor's helm popped up out of the tunnel, and he lifted two civilians up.
I'll draw their fire. You attack once I have their attention. Sharia will transport the wounded with the locals. Link back up with us after that.
Comms are out,
Sharia's voice echoed out of the tunnel.
How do I find you?
Is cavalry here? How many are you down there?
Morris leaned over to peer into the tunnel.
We'll find Colonel Martell. He'll be where the fighting's the hardest. Meet us there,
Gideon said. He crawled out of the building and rose to his full height. The Ibarans on the second floor tensed up as he looked at them. Gideon pointed two fingers at his optics, then one finger at the Ibarans, and took off at a trot down the street.
Wait! How are you going to get past the tank's shields?
Morris called out. Gideon charged the magnetic accelerators in his twin Gauss cannons as his audio receptors filtered through the noise of the city and pinpointed the Cassatt tank a block away. It was moving forward slowly. Gideon ran along the street and then went prone. He spotted the tank's treads through the windows and aimed his Gauss barrels at the center of his target. He fired. The twin bolts blew through the walls and struck the tank's flank. There was a flare of blue light around the treads and it lurched forward. Gideon popped back onto his feet just as the tank's turret boomed. Flying bricks and glass bounced off his armor as the shell tore through the building behind him.
Damn it!
Gideon charged through the building between him and the tank, betting his life on the tank's reloading the turret slower than he could close the distance. The tank was squat and the hull bore tribal markings. A tangle of still bloody bones hung from halfway down the barrel. Suddenly a machine gun in the upper turret opened up. Bullets beat against Gideon's armor as he veered to one side, keeping out of the way of the turret as it turned toward him. He felt each hit against his armor, heard the bang through his suit's audio, and through the womb as the machine gun assaulted him. Gideon ducked underneath the turret just as it fired again. He punched the machine gun port and crushed the red-hot muzzle into scrap. Then, grabbing the base of the turret's tube, he swung himself onto the forward edge of the tank. Gideon lifted his right foot and his diamond-tipped anchor stabbed out of his heel. He rammed the spike into the driver's hatch and felt it hit home, into something soft. As Gideon slammed his fingertips into the edge of a top hatch and dug into the metal seam, he heard the squeal of treads and looked up. Another tank rolled into the next intersection and brought its turret to bear. Gideon dropped down in front of the tank he'd been standing on and ducked. The other tank fired on its fellow Cassatt, the shell breaking through the rear armor and hitting the ammunition stored in the back of the turret. The tank exploded, sending Gideon flying into a wall that crumbled against the impact. His HUD went red as his armor tried to parse the damage across his front. Gideon found himself in a seat made of bricks, his arms propped up in the building's wall. Bits of the destroyed tank were embedded across his chest and legs, still smoking. The other tank rolled forward. Gideon tried to get up, but his servos locked up. The tank aimed its barrel at him, and Gideon stared into the darkness of the muzzle as he fought to stand up. Eignar landed on the tank, grabbed the tube, and pulled it up, the metal groaning. The tank fired, sending the round into the air and missing Gideon. The barrel snapped in half with a crack, and smoke wafted out of the stubby section still attached to the turret. Eignar impaled his improvised stake into the top of the turret, collapsing the top hatch. He tossed the tube aside, jammed his Gauss cannon arm into the opening, and fired a single bullet that ricocheted through the inside of the tank. Eignar jumped off as smoke billowed out of the turret and flames licked the edges of the hatch.
Sir!
Eignar grabbed Gideon's hand and pulled him to his feet.
The shields are the best thing on those hunks of junk!
Gideon plucked a bit of shrapnel from his chest and dropped it. He bent a knee, then locked it out with a snap.
Close-range concussion. Had to restart the actuators.
Where to now? Eignar asked. Gideon pointed to tracer fire and explosions to the south of the city.
There. Martell will be there.
Chapter 25. Admiral Leto fought back a curse as the destroyer Dempsey exploded inside his holotank, her death taking a number of the Cassatt fighters down with her. He rewound the last few minutes of the destroyer's life in the tank.
Porcupine rounds proving more effective than our simulations, Paxton said. Though I don't know what will run out first, the munitions or their fighters.
Leto swung the holo back to the battle. His picket ships kept up a constant barrage of missiles that burst into self-guiding munitions in the middle of Cassatt fighter formations. His capital ships hung back, their batteries trained on the oncoming enemy armada, still too far away to engage with any degree of success. The enemy had fed its fighters into the meat grinder of the Terran Union's anti-void craft munitions. They had managed to overwhelm a few destroyers at significant losses, tactics no human commander would use.
30 minutes until artillery ships have range, Paxton said.
Leto zoomed in on the Ibarra ships. Most of Makarov's fleet had taken position over the main city, her fighters and landers making constant trips between the city and ships. Two carriers and escorts had joined the Terran formation, but their captains had remained tight-lipped, sending out strikes to beat back any incursions through Leto's screen. A single Ibarran cargo ship remained over the northern pole, a squadron of battlecruisers guarding it.
Erickson, the admiral said, pulling up a screen for his fellow commander.
Said I want flechette rounds loaded. This is combat, not a training exercise. The safety protocols are secondary to getting the goddamn munitions loaded, gunnery.
Erickson didn't yell, but the tone of her voice could have cut steel. She finally noticed the open channel with Leto.
Arden?
Normandy. What are the Ibarras doing? Why did Makarov leave so much of her line back with the cargo ship?
Leto asked.
Decent question. Better question is, why we're taking it on the chin while she holds back?
You have the fight. It's time to see how committed the Ibarras really are to this joint defense.
Leto muted Erickson, but kept her line open so she could monitor his next hail. Makarov appeared a few seconds later. He considered this young woman, who did bear a resemblance to the long-lost admiral and hero of Earth.
Leto, I'm impressed with how well your ships are.
What are you doing with that cargo ship?
Leto snapped.
You've got a token force with me, while most of your guns are parked over the city.
This is an evacuation.
Makarov's eyes glittered.
The more ships I put to that effort, the sooner it will end.
The void is no place for ships full of civilians, Admiral,
Leto said.
One hit to the cargo hold and they're breathing vacuum. You're young, but you're not stupid.
Why don't I establish void superiority before conducting the evacuation, just like the manual demands? Because the crucible is down and will be inoperable for days, that's why. I've got my own way home, she said.
There's only one crucible in this system, Leto shook his head. We need a solution to the Cassatt that are here before we worry about an exit.
Incorrect, Makarov said. I told you, we have our own way home.
Leto reached into the holo and zoomed in on the mysterious cargo ship. The bays were open, and ship tenders with oversized engines brought long segments of dark stone stacked in the ship like cordwood.
"You have a modular gate," Leto said.
"Indeed. Your government has their R&D program in the works. The Ibarra nations had a greater need for the technology, and we have a number of working prototypes,"
Makarov said.
"That's how your fleet escaped Oricon," Leto said.
"And that's how you'll get your ships out,"
she said.
"Unless you want to slug it out with the entire Kasat armada. You hold the line until I've got the civilians away, then you've got a one-way ticket to a nearby system with a crucible."
Leto ran a quick simulation in the holotank.
"The Kasat armada will reach the planet in less than 4 hours. You're going to get every civilian, your fleet and mine, through that gate before then?"
"No,"
she frowned.
"As usual, the only resource we don't have enough of is time. But we can slow the Kasat. Just need a bulldog. Which is where you come in."
"Details. Now."
Chapter 26. A constant whine filled Major Whitelaw's ears as he came to. Feeling pain around his ankles, he rolled onto his side and found both his boots in a small fire. He crawled forward, the left side of his body stinging from the pain of a dozen lacerations. As his hearing returned, the sound of Gauss fire and shouting came through, and he saw a Gauss rifle jutting out from under a broken armor panel from the city's wall. Whitelaw grabbed it and pulled out half a weapon, the capacitor sparking as he tossed it aside.
"Edson!"
The major crawled onto his knees, and that hurt too. The walls shook as Kasat artillery beyond the walls kept up their barrage.
"Anybody?"
The bunker he'd been in had taken a direct hit. He touched a fallen ranger, and the cracked screen on his faceplate showed a flat line for the other ranger's heart. The snap of Gauss fire came through the door that hung off the top hinge. He coughed and shouldered his way through. Rangers and legionnaires stood on the parapet, firing over the side and ducking as Kasat energy bolt snapped up at them. A legionnaire grabbed Whitelaw by the shoulders. The cross on his faceplate faded away, and he saw Hansen's face.
"Status!"
Whitelaw mumbled, tasting blood but choking it back.
"Wave attack,"
Hansen said, pressing an Ibarra pistol into his hand.
"I've got close air support coming in, but it won't help us."
"They teach you to quit in your legion? Rangers always accomplish!"
He leaned against the wall and felt the pain deep in his stomach, though he didn't look at the wound. Knowing how bad it was wouldn't make any difference.
"Shut up and shoot!"
Hansen turned Whitelaw toward the firing port. The Ibarran hefted a large Gauss rifle and fired down the wall. Whitelaw put his finger to the pistol's trigger and pulled a frag grenade off his harness. Ignoring the blood on the weapon, he flicked the pin away with his thumb, looked around the firing port, and froze. Climbing with their bare hands, thousands of Raka soldiers swarmed up the walls, and open-topped transports disgorged more of the foot soldiers behind the tide of bodies. Sanheel officers moved amongst the Raka, still clambering to get up the walls, the Sanheel beating at the Raka, kicking some for no reason Whitelaw could tell. A line of Kasat tanks and the planes beyond the walls fired, pounding the defensive positions atop the walls. Whitelaw tossed the grenade over the edge and emptied the pistol into the oncoming wave as fast as he could pull the trigger. Accuracy meant little when it was almost impossible to miss.
"We need armor support!"
Hansen ducked back as Kasat energy bolts sprang off the parapet.
"I thought you said your armor was here!"
Whitelaw reached around his back and removed a thick metal rod.
"They're to the east, dealing with a breakthrough!"
The legionnaire touched the side of his helmet.
"Still 2 minutes out on that air support!"
"At least you have comms,"
Whitelaw said.
"Gonna have to do this the old-fashioned way."
He pulled the cap on one end of the rod back and set the color of the star cluster to red. Then he twisted the rod, feeling it click through his gloves. Whitelaw stuck the cap against the metal floor of the parapet, and a red spark the size of his fist spat out and flew down the street, casting blood-colored light that shone off broken windows. 2 more sparks shot off, then Whitelaw tossed it aside.
"If they saw that, my armor will come."
Whitelaw looked over and found Hansen slumped against the parapet.
"Hansen!"
He gave the Ibarran a shake, and he fell back, still eyes staring up at the sky, a bloody hole in his chest. The muted sound of shouting came from the Legionnaire's helmet. Whitelaw twisted the helmet free and gently laid the dead man to one side.
"This is Strike Team Delta. How copy?"
came from the helmet.
"Delta, this is Major Whitelaw, 85th Ranger Regiment. Hansen is down. ETA?"
Whitelaw hefted the Legionnaire's oversized rifle and was struggling to wield it with one hand when a Raka jumped over the parapet and howled. A Ranger shot it in the head and threw the body off the side before it could hit the ground. Whitelaw heard a growl and swung the heavy rifle up just as another Raka stuck its head through a firing port. One squeeze of the trigger blew it in half. The head and shoulder landed at Whitelaw's feet, and he kicked it away.
"Enemy is too close!"
shouted the pilot on the other end of the radio.
"No way we can—" "I know how goddamn close they are! Fire on my position, you understand? Fire on my position!"
A hairy Raka hand reached down and grabbed Whitelaw by the wrist. He pulled against the alien, his power armor proving more than a match for the Raka's muscles. The Raka landed in a puddle of blood and swiped at Whitelaw. The Ranger grabbed the alien by the throat and stared into its beady red eyes. He slammed Hansen's helmet into the Raka's head, cracking the cybernetic implants on the side of its skull, and continued to beat the helmet against the Raka's head over and over as the sound of jet engines closed in.
"Are you sure?"
Martell came to a stop as he looked toward the southern wall.
"Red Star Cluster? I'm positive,"
Tongea said. The thunderclap of bombs reverberated through the city.
"Get Matthias and Duncan."
Martell pointed to where the rest of his lance was digging through a collapsed building. He looked to an elevated highway and saw the red armor of an Ulan. A line of vehicles loaded down with civilians drove past the armor. Martell turned up the power on his IR transmitter.
"Sobieski, the battle's not going well,"
he sent. The Ulan turned around.
"Keine Schlag deiner Rettungsaktion,"
Sobieski said.
"English."
"Sorry, it's not a battle, it's a retreat. Did you see that Red Star Cluster?"
Sobieski said.
"I'm moving south to support, and so are you. Do you have comms with the Odinsons?"
"It's spotty. I'll relay your order."
"Move. Situation may be in doubt."
Martell closed the channel and ran south, Tongea and the rest of their lance falling in behind him. He turned a corner and found a building collapsed across the highway, the frame still largely intact as if it had been built on its side, leading to the southern wall. A tower of smoke billowed up in the distance. Kasat crescent-shaped fighters fought with the Ibarra fighters with the forward-swept wings.
"Rook, rook!"
carried down the highway.
"That sound like ours,"
Tongea said. He stepped into the toppled building and worked his way through to the other side. Martell went through the floor next to him. Raka poured over the wall and through a wide gap blasted in the parapet. The aliens clustered at the bottom, chanting and banging their fists rhythmically against the ground. A larger Raka with a half-cloak made of bones climbed onto a bus and held a human head high. On the remains of the city's walls behind the shaman were human corpses spiked to the wall. Ibarra legionnaires hung next to Terran rangers.
"Rock!"
The shaman shouted, and the Raka beat at the ground faster.
"Pergalah, human!"
The shaman shook the head, then set it at its feet. Sanheel slapped at the Raka and beat their rifle butts against their heads, but the Raka were entranced by the shaman.
"Looks like a war dance," Tongea said.
"There's too many of them. Not enough of us."
Martell looked down the highway.
"We need the Ulans and Odinsons before we attack."
The shaman pointed down the highway, and the Raka tore at their faces and chests, many of them drawing blood. Raka at the edge of the mass broke away and ran down the highway, then doubled back toward the shaman.
"We need time. Let me show them my war face," Tongea said.
"What?
Tongea?"
Martell reached over to the Maori as he broke through the crumbling walls and into the open. Tongea's speakers hummed as he turned them up to full volume. The Raka went silent as the war machine approached. Tongea raised a foot and slammed it into the ground in a wide stance.
"Kamate!"
The words reverberated down the highway as Tongea beat his forearms against his legs with a clang of metal on metal.
"Kamate kaura, kaura!"
"Sir," Duncan said. "What the hell is he doing?"
"The Haka."
Martell looked back. and saw the rest of his armor racing toward them. Tongea braced both arms across his chest.
Tenete tangata!
Blared from his speakers. He went to one knee and pounded a fist into the road so hard it cracked the street. Asanhiel brought its long rifle up, but Raka mobbed it, ripping the rifle away and beating the Sanhiel about the head and shoulders with it. Tongea stomped his feet against the road and slapped his hands against his chest.
Na-na-ne-tiki!
Tongea beat at his chest again and again.
My fukafititera!
The shaman picked the head up and shook it at Tongea.
Ah, upane!
Tongea took a single step forward.
Kaupane!
Another step. The raka swarmed toward Tongea.
Fititera!
Tongea slashed a thumb across his throat and beat his fists to his chest as thousands of aliens bore down on him like a tidal wave.
Verum corde!
Came from the building, and 10 suits of armor burst out of the wreck and charged the raka. Tongea clapped his hands against the head of a blood-crazed raka as it jumped toward him. Its skull splattered, and Tongea crushed 2 more aliens with the single swipe of his hand. He brought his rotary cannon up and sent the barrels spinning. Bullets ripped through the raka, slaughtering them by the dozens each second. Tongea fired his gauss cannons into a Sanhiel screaming at his uncontrolled soldiers and blew its chest open. Tongea pointed over the raka at the shaman, still on top of the bus.
Kamate!
Tongea charged toward the shaman, and Raka scrambled out of the way. The shaman dropped the head and shrank toward the edge of the bus. Tongea grabbed him by the leg, hoisted the alien into the air, and slammed it into the ground, cracking its bones. Then Tongea slammed his heel against the shaman's head and ground it into paste. The Raka faltered, their battle rage suddenly gone. The armor did not falter. They spread into a circle around the aliens and killed them with bursts from their rotary cannons, and with their fists and feet, until they met each other in the center. Purple blood stained Tongea from his knees to his boots, elbows to fingertips. Martell looked across the field of dead, then pounded a fist against his breastplate in salute to Tongea. Tongea nodded, then looked to the east.
More! There are more to fight, Tongea said.
Let's find them, Martell said.
Chapter 27 Leto waited as his artillery ships maneuvered between his ships and the oncoming Kasat armada. The Kasat battleships spread out in reaction, but not as fast as they had the last few times Leto had fainted with his long-range ships.
You think she's setting us up? Erickson asked.
Funny thing about our artillery ships, he said. They can range Makarov's crucible as well as the Kasat's. If she doesn't deliver, they'll destroy her gate before it's even finished. Self-repair or not, if she hangs us out to dry, she'll get to deal with everything that gets through us.
You didn't tell her this.
Some things are best left implied.
Ready fleet maneuver in 5, 4.
Leto felt the Ardennes shift ever so slightly as their fleet turned, sending them on a course that would cross ahead of the Kasat armada.
Makarov sent the first signal, Erickson said, looking away from her screen. Activity on the moon's surface detected.
Gunnery, engage fire plan Alpha 9,
Leto ordered. The artillery ships reoriented and the long rail cannon vanes pointed toward a Kasat battleship at the front of the formation. Hypervelocity rounds shot out. Leto tracked their course through the holotank, and more rail cannon shots rose up from the moon. Dozens of rail shots converged in the Kasat formation. Smaller enemy ships tried to set themselves between the incoming threats, but the sheer volume of fire and the close-packed formation gave the Kasat few chances. 2 battleships broke apart along with another dozen escort ships. Leto allowed himself a smile as 2 cruisers collided.
Enemy strength decreased by 11%,
Paxton said. She frowned as more rail cannon rounds tracked up from the moon.
They have more batteries? Leto asked.
Negative, sir, Paxton said. Same point of origin. Their rate of fire is a hell of a lot better than our surface emplacements.
A chill went down Leto's back. The Ibaras had significant defenses around their colony. Far more guns that could put up a significant weight of fire than intelligence anticipated.
Artillery ships, Keep to the firing order. Target priority on the leading ships, Leto said.
Claw ships at the fore of the armada accelerated, reaching toward the human ships. He reached into the tank to redirect a frigate squadron, but Erickson beat him to the punch.
Come on.
Leto tapped a finger against the edge of his holotank. Three Cassat battleships broke off from the main formation and changed course toward the moon. Even with the Cassat breaking off to deal with the threat behind them, they outnumbered his two fleets by more than 4-1. Makarov's portrait flashed and he touched the edge.
Admiral, we've a slight complication, she said. The arrival of so many fleets upset the graviton field around the planets. I've had to rework the firing solution.
Now you realize this? Leto asked.
I need you to hold them for 9 minutes.
Makarov swallowed hard.
That's more twice what we planned. Time under fire, but that's the only way this will work.
Your mistake will cost lives, Leto said. My sailors' lives.
If we don't do this right, we'll all die.
Makarov said.
Trust me.
A timer appeared over her picture.
Cassat fighters breaking for the artillery ships, Paxton said.
My fleet will fight, Makarov.
Leto cut the line to the Ibaran admiral.
XO, have the artillery squadrons complete their next fire mission and burn back to our formation.
He watched as his ships continued their intercept course toward the Cassat advance. At their current speeds, the Cassat would cross the T in front of his ships, exposing the Terran ships to full broadsides from the aliens. He was bumbling into a beating, and the Cassat commander had to see it.
Arden, Erickson said. I ever tell you what the older Makarov did with the Breitenfeld during the Toth incursion?
I've studied the battle, Leto said. She used the Breitenfeld's jump drives to drop you inside their formation, then Valdar let loose laser-guided torps that tore the heart out of the Toth fleet.
And Makarov sent her 8th fleet into the Toth guns to hold them in place. This new one thinks and acts like her mother, Erickson said. I just don't see how it's possible she can be who she says she is. The math is wrong.
We'll connect the dots later,
Leto said. The Ardenne shuddered as her rail batteries opened fire.
We've got to sell this attack, or nothing else matters.
Chapter 28. Roland loaded another heavy Gauss round into his Mauser and fired from the hip on a Cassat tank as its turret slewed toward him. The round tore through the shields and hit the thin armor covering the fuel cells. The tank exploded, tossing the turret straight up like a flipped coin. He charged forward, slipping another round off the side of the large rifle and into the chamber. Around a church, the Cassat had built a hasty barricade of electrified wires running between shield emitters. Raka and Sonheel scrambled behind the shields, the sudden destruction of the tank outside the perimeter goading them into action like a kicked hive.
We're here for leadership, Nicodemus said. Second emitter from the left of the tank.
Roland hefted his rifle to his shoulder and took aim, still running forward.
Fire!
The three Mausers let off a ripple of shots that overwhelmed the emitter. Electricity looped back through the wires, stabbing out and frying Raka that were too close. The emitter exploded as the armor charged through the breach. Roland locked his rifle onto his back and lowered his shoulder at a Sonheel that burst through the church doors. He crushed the alien against the stone facade, earning a crack of bones and a wet grunt as the Cassat officer died. A group of Raka jumped on him, stabbing at the joints of his armor with serrated knives. Roland backhanded one off his leg, sending it on a quick but brief flight into the side of the church. He heard the whirl of a rotary cannon from Nicodemus or Morrigan and felt a tug as a Raka on his back was shot off. An alien yelled as it pulled the pin on two grenades and charged at Roland. He kicked the Raka and sent it barreling into another group of their infantry as they came around the corner. The grenades exploded and saved Roland the trouble of dealing with them.
In! Go!
Nicodemus charged through a stained glass window. Roland heard Gauss fire as he bashed down the main doors. The inside of the church angled down and pews had been broken and pushed against the entrance. The main floor now held Cassat equipment and holoprojectors. A Sonheel in deep purple armor stood where the pulpit had been, in front of a pile of dead human bodies that lay behind him. The officer held an Ibaran soldier against his chest, shielding himself. The man bled from a gash down one side of his face and his chest. He was still breathing, but on the verge of bleeding to death. Dead Raka and a live Ixion were strewn across the command center. Roland crushed the broken pews like they were dried twigs as he and the rest of his new lance advanced into the church. He aimed his Gauss cannons at the Sonheel's face, but one hit to the alien shields would probably kill the soldier.
"It doesn't matter," said the purple-clad alien. "All your kind will die. What matters is whether any will serve. Reduce the strain on your species by toiling for our great truth."
"I've dealt with this before," Roland said, lessening the magnetic hold of the sword locked to his left hip.
"Witness the future."
The Sonheel wrapped a hand around his human shield's head and snapped his neck. Nicodemus and Morrigan opened fire instantly, shredding the Sonheel and the dead man into a bloody mess. That neither of them attempted to spare the dead man's form told Roland just how ruthless the Ibaran armor had become.
"Don't wreck the equipment,"
Nicodemus said, going to a blood-splattered holotank and holding up a hand. His wrist opened and a scanner node extended out.
"They're communicating through their own interference. Maybe we can learn how."
"Perimeter."
Morrigan pointed at the other side of the church, and Roland stepped around the equipment. The church walls had been pierced by bullets, and most of the stained glass windows along the sides were shattered. The sound of the raging battle filtered through. The muffled crump of explosions, snap of Raka weapons, and roar of fighters locked in combat made him feel like they would never leave the city. One window remained mostly intact, depicting an older suit of armor pinning a Zaros master to the ground with a glass and gold sword. The Zaros looked like a demon of fire and obsidian, grasping at the armor as it died. Roland caught movement out another window, a group of Raka moving away from the command center.
"They're not coming for us?"
Roland asked.
"Maybe they know when they can't win,"
Morrigan said.
"Got this one."
Nicodemus turned his scanner to a barrel-shaped object with a crown of crystals. A soft ululation sounded over Roland's head. He jerked his cannons up, but there was nothing in the rafters. Sunlight filtered through cracks in the ceiling, and the wooden beams rattled in tune with distant explosions.
"Did you hear that?"
Roland asked.
"Brave meat. Foolish meat,"
hissed from the front of the church. Roland scanned through his visual filters, but found nothing.
"Heroes die. They always die,"
echoed around them. Nicodemus snapped his hand back in place and drew his sword. The blade extended from the hilt and gleamed as light from the Kassad equipment reflected off the razor-sharp edge. He backed toward the center of the room, Morrigan and Roland following his lead.
"The last one demands Trueborn."
The ululation returned, louder this time.
"These are always Trueborn. Give yourself to him. Honor yourselves."
"We give nothing," Nicodemus said. "Come and claim us."
A ribbon of light deformed along the wall just above the broken windows. The deformity leaped at Roland, and he had just enough time to throw a punch as it slammed into him. His fist connected, and a stealth field collapsed as the impact shoved him into Morrigan's back. A Toth warrior, clad in bulky crystal armor, latched clawed feet against Roland's waist and legs. The reptilian reared up, raised its arms to the side, and struck at either side of Roland's helm. Roland got his arms up and blocked the blows. The Toth pressed his arms in, grasping for his optics. Roland's actuator strained against the alien strength and found he couldn't overpower this foe. Inside the Toth's multifaceted faceplate, Roland saw a forked tongue press against the crystal. Roland raised his arms up, then slammed his upper body toward the ground. The Toth took the brunt of the impact, and Roland got his cannon arm free. He fired a double shot into the Toth's chest, cracking the armor. The Toth released its hold on Roland's waist and legs and attempted to squirm away. Roland extended his fingers and drove them into the broken armor like a dagger. As the strike punctured the crystal and his hand invaded the flesh beneath, the Toth let off a high-pitched scream. Roland gripped a handful of organs in the alien's chest cavity and ripped his hand out. Yellow blood bubbled out of the wound, and Roland tossed a beating heart aside. Roland looked aside and saw Morrigan lying on her back, a Toth warrior bent over her clawing at her breastplate. She was still fighting, knocking aside blows as best she could. Roland drew his sword, brought the hilt back to his hip as the blade extended, ready to ram the weapon into the Toth so focused on Morrigan, and caught a blur of motion to his side just as he struck at the Toth. A glint of light passed in front of his helm, and a blow jarred his sword out of his hand. A Toth with a crystal-edged halberd jabbed the spike on his weapon at Roland. The tip struck his chest and pushed into the armor, glancing off his womb. Roland's HUD went berserk with warnings as he brought a hand up and chopped at the haft. The halberd broke, but the axe head and spike remained embedded in his chest. The Toth swung the other end of his weapon, tipped with a spiked mace head, against Roland's lower back. The impact rattled him inside his womb. He sent an impulse for his Gauss cannons to reload and swung a hasty fist at the Toth. The snap of two Gauss rounds loading into place echoed through the church. The warrior ducked the blow and brought the mace down toward Roland's head. Roland caught the Toth by the wrist and punched at it with his other hand. The Toth brought its foreleg up, grabbed the Gauss cannon arm, and used all its strength to push Roland's aim away, and straight toward the Toth, still beating on Morrigan. Roland fired and blew an arm off the Toth over his lancemate. There was a flash of crystal, and the Toth, still grappling with Roland, whipped its tail up and struck him in the helm. His faceplate cracked, and his vision swam as his armor tried to compensate for the damage. He ducked his helm down as the next strike dented the black armor and broke antennae loose. The Toth grabbed his wrist with another foot and stretched his arms out. Roland felt the strain on his servos as the alien tried to tear him apart.
"I'll have you, meat!"
the alien hissed.
"I'll feast on your—"
A sword point burst through its face from behind, and it went limp. Roland shrugged the corpse off just as Morrigan set a boot against the Toth's back and ripped her sword free. Nicodemus kicked at a pile of three dead warriors at his feet.
"Thanks," she said.
"Same,"
Roland responded as he reached for his sword hilt and missed, grabbing at air.
"I can't tell if it's my servos or optics that are off."
He tried again, but his fingers refused to grasp. Nicodemus picked up Roland's sword, returned the blade to the hilt, and slapped it against the maglock.
"It's both," he said. "Your armor will compensate for the damage. Give it a minute."
"No more speculation," Morrigan said. "The Toth are alive, and they're behind the Kasat."
"Lady Ibarra will need proof to show Earth and the rest of the galaxy."
Nicodemus ripped a hand and forearm off a Toth warrior and shook out the yellow blood.
"The Toth."
Roland looked over one of the crystal-armored bodies, wondering just how they designed their exoskeletons to match his strength.
"What does this mean?"
"There will be no peace between us and the Kasat," Nicodemus said. "Not now. Not ever. The Toth twisted them into their servants, made them fanatics, and the only way to deal with a true believer is to kill them. No middle ground, no compromise."
"I'm oddly comfortable with that,"
Morrigan said. The ground shook, a low rumble that reverberated through the church.
"That wasn't an explosion," Roland said.
The rumble returned, and a shadow passed over the street outside. Roland went to the stained glass image of the armor slaying the Zaros master and saw, several blocks away, the top of a walker moving between buildings. The design was more delicate than anything he'd seen from the Kasat before. A cone-shaped head and spindly veins extending up from the shoulders. It stopped in an intersection, and Roland saw it had large crystals mounted to the side of its egg-shaped torso instead of arms. Thick legs extended down from hip actuators beneath the torso. The opal blue surface gleamed in the sunlight.
I've not seen one of those before, Roland said. Is it new?
It looks new. Shields flared around the walker as Gauss bullets struck home. Panels in the top of the torso opened, and missiles fired, arcing up and away. It swung to one side, and the crystals lit up. Roland dimmed his optics as the crystals let off a torrent of energy that obliterated a residential building. It continued on, heading for the spaceport.
"It's new." Nicodemus lifted his chin. "Command says the Mausers aren't getting through. Every time we shoot at it, it responds with missiles, and it slags another building. Air support can't get near it."
"Then we hit it with rail cannons," Roland said.
"Shields are too strong," Nicodemus said. "Look at this."
He sent video of the walker under fire. Ley lines of energy appeared along the shields as they flared.
"The emitters must be there,"
Morrigan said, highlighting spots on the walker's torso.
They have to drop the shields to get the missiles through, Roland said. You saw the way they arced? We'd have to come in from the top.
Here.
Nicodemus brought up a map of the city and tagged several buildings along the most direct route from the walker's location to the spaceport.
Another lance can poke the bear for us. It's up to us to take it down. Let's move.
Roland ran down an alley,